Hi, everyone. This is Joe Bianco, co-producer and co-host of the Defining Moments podcast. Have you known anyone who has battled cancer? Do you remember when the U.S. led a global campaign on the war on drugs? When the pandemic arrived, how did you weather the storm? Did you experience COVID-19 as a deadly enemy? Or maybe you thought of the highly contagious, omnipresent virus as glitter that gets everywhere? Today, we're talking about a topic near and dear to my heart. Metaphors. We'll discover how the language we use to make sense of and communicate our experiences can shape those experiences in surprising ways. We'll touch on the overuse of battle metaphors in cancer and the public discourse of COVID-19, but we'll also explore the healing capacity of language, the power of using humor in healthcare situations, and how the key to reframing our most challenging problems is just a metaphor away. I am honored to introduce today's guest, Dr. Elena Cimino, an applied linguistics scholar. Dr. Cimino is a distinguished professor in the Department of Linguistics and English Language at Lancaster University and director of the ESRC Center for Corpus Approaches to Social Science. She's a fellow of the UK's Royal Society of Arts and the Academy of Social Sciences and serves as associate editor of the journal Metaphor and Symbol. Dr. Cimino specializes in health communication, medical humanities, and metaphor theory and analysis. Her most recent focus has been on communication about pain, mental illness, COVID-19, and vaccinations. Her health communication article, Not Soldiers But Firefighters, Metaphors in COVID-19, serves as a centerpiece for our conversation today. You can find links to the article in the show notes. Elena, I am so excited to have this conversation with you. Welcome to the Defining Moments podcast.
Thank you for having me. It's really good to be here.
So, Elena, you once said that you hadn't planned a career in linguistics or even knew about the field until college, when you discovered language could be a field of study all unto itself. Can you recreate for us that defining moment in your life?
Yes, I can. I must say, I did high school in Italy, and I did a lot of work on language. I studied Latin and ancient Greek for 5 years. But when I went to university to study English and German language and literature, I really did not know that linguistics existed or that it was a subject in its own right. And there were various things that made me realize how broad linguistics is. So, for example, I remember being introduced to the debate about how we acquire language as, or multiple languages as infants. So there's a disagreement as to whether we have a special, separate, innate mechanism for language acquisition or whether language is learned through processes and structures that are actually not specific to language. Another moment was when I was introduced to an area called pragmatics that, amongst other things, looked at how we do things with words. So there are certain utterances that change the world, like if the right person says, I declare you husband and wife, at that point the world changes. And, you know, linguistics extends to many other things, the study of grammar, the study of how we make sounds using, you know, our mouths and respiratory system. And so, yes, once I discovered it, I was hooked.
And this led to a very prolific and fascinating career. You are an applied linguistics scholar, correct?
Yes, I am.
And can you tell us what that means as opposed to other areas in linguistics?
As you can imagine, in many other areas of academia, people use the term applied linguistics differently, but I'll tell you the kinds of things that it covers. It covers some things I do not study, which is, for example, language teaching. So what are the best ways of teaching additional languages to children, adults, people with different characteristics? What are the best techniques? What are the best kinds of tasks? How do we assess linguistic competence in, for example, people who are learning English as an additional language. And these things are high stakes. In many contexts, you need to assess linguistic abilities, to admit people to college or university, or to give people citizenship. So this is a big area in applied linguistics. But applied linguistics also covers more broadly doing research in any setting where language matters or linguistic problems or issues need to be taken into account. So it goes all the way from the application of linguistics even to discover, to try to solve crimes. So for example, if somebody disappears and there are texts coming from their mobile phone, how do we establish whether those texts are genuinely from the person or from someone else who has got hold of the phone? In my case, how do we make sure that communication about illness, whether it be cancer or COVID or pain, is as sensitive as possible and effective as possible for patients? So applied linguistics covers all these different areas and more.
So it really covers a wide range of things. And your work in particular draws upon social media platforms. It draws upon public discourse, online journals of cancer survivors to collect metaphors, to analyze language, and to understand how language is used by the people who are most affected by these situations. So that would transition us now to talking about metaphors, which seems to be the heart of a lot of what you do.
Yes, it is.
Yeah, and what it's a fascinating world that I think will surprise many people. You know, in the U.S., we tend to learn about metaphors in maybe sixth grade or elementary school, and basically we learn their definition, and then we learn how to differentiate them from a simile.
Yes.
And that's kind of where it ends. Your work shows that there is so much more to metaphors than that. So can you describe what a metaphor is as you see it, and what functions do metaphors serve?
Yes, so metaphor involves talking and crucially, potentially thinking about one thing in terms of another, where the two things are different, but we can perceive some similarities between them. So, for example, when people talk about fighting a battle against cancer, they're talking about one thing, having an illness and trying to get better or to live as well as possible with it, in terms of another, which is fighting a battle against an enemy. The two things are different, but we can perceive similarities between them. Both are difficult, both could be potentially deadly, etc. And crucially, the use of the metaphor itself in order to be interpreted pushes us to find similarities between the two things. And that understanding of one thing in terms of another is what is known as the framing function of metaphor, which is why metaphor is so important. I should also add that this broad view of metaphor, rather confusingly for the elementary school perspective, actually often captures both metaphors and similes. So metaphors and similes are sometimes seen as different linguistic manifestations or formulations of the same, if you like, figurative comparison. So for some purposes, it makes sense to distinguish between them. But for some purposes, metaphor encompasses everything, and then we make a distinction between metaphorical expressions and similes. But this is a kind of technical thing. They're not quite as different as sometimes we're led to think in school.
Right. It sounds like, especially with the framing effects, it doesn't quite matter as much. As a psychologist, I think some of the power of a metaphor specifically is the fact that it's immediate. It's a direct sort of experience. You say that, I feel like an elephant is sitting on my chest. There's an elephant sitting on my chest. Or it kind of is a very direct and evocative way to convey an experience. Whereas, as we learned in grammar school, similes are less direct. Something is like something else. But I see what you're saying in terms of, from a linguistics point of view, the framing effects can be very much the same. And they, they're all part of trying to find a proxy for describing experience.
Yes, and actually the example you've just given is a really excellent one. You know, I feel like there's an elephant sitting on my chest to talk about physical or emotional pain or something like that, because metaphors help us to express experiences that might be subjective, like what it feels like to be uncomfortable or in pain or upset. And so experiences are subjective, and therefore your own personal ones that cannot be accessed directly by somebody else, in terms of something else that is easier to imagine. And even though most of us have not experienced an elephant sitting on our chest, we can imagine what that feels like. And that is the power of metaphor to help us express something that might be subjective or abstract or complex, invisible, in terms of something that is more image rich, more concrete, and more intersubjectively accessible.
Mm, excellent. And so then returning to something you mentioned earlier, you know, your research shows that both in cancer and in situations like COVID-19, that battle and war metaphors are very prevalent. And you discuss in your research sort of the advantages and disadvantages of our over-reliance on war and battle metaphors. Can you talk about that a little more? Why you think they're so prevalent?
Yes. So the most prevalent metaphors, which we call in metaphor studies conventional metaphors that often apply across languages, tend to draw from very basic physical sort of sensory motor experiences. And one such basic experience is having someone else frustrate our goals or possibly threaten our own survival. So it could be somebody taking something away from us or somebody threatening us with violence or being aggressive in physical terms. So that experience is very basic. It can be experienced even by animals, but it can be experienced by small children, and it can be experienced in all sorts of different circumstances. Now, then what we do with metaphor is we take that very basic physical idea of a problem being faced with an opponent that takes stuff away or beats us up, and we use it to talk and potentially think about all sorts of more complex, abstract, and less tangible problems that might be being sick, or it might be being in debt, or it might be, a government trying to deal with a difficult problem. So that difficulties or problems are then metaphorically talked about in terms of opponents. And at that point, you can have a fight against anything. You can fight an illness, you can fight debt, a government can fight inflation or poverty. Then that takes us to the most extreme type of physical opponent you may find, which is an army associated with a different country, and that is war. So then war becomes a metaphor for very large, long-standing, hard-to-deal-with problems. And that is why those metaphors are so pervasive, because this idea of a problem being seen as a physical opponent is based in our very primary sensory motor experience and is so usefully generalized to all sorts of other experiences.
So I can see why these conventional metaphors are so prevalent, I guess, and so commonly used, but it sounds like what you're saying is that they arise from a certain anxiety, in a sense. The perception of threat then generalizes into metaphors of invasion, of attack, being embattled.
Yes, and you can see that. You can see that both in the history of human beings, that survival involves making sure that you and the people who matter to you are safe and your territory is safe, and at the level of the individual, that you are safe and that your things and the things you care about are safe in your own development. And that is such a pervasive experience that then it can get applied to anything else that is more complicated and more abstract. And metaphors have this ability to make something that is very complex much more simple and clear cut and image rich, and a fight, a battle is those things precisely.
And your research also points out the effects of those choices to simplify something complex, to evoke battles, enemies, wars. You talked in your health communication article on the pandemic, you mentioned the problems associated with public figures such as Boris Johnson and Donald Trump declaring COVID an enemy and later claiming victory over the virus. We were too strong to be defeated. So what are the implications when a public figure like that frames a narrative and frames the metaphor, especially during a time of uncertainty like in the pandemic?
Yes, there are many implications. First of all, the fact that we've already said these metaphors are very pervasive. So when they're then applied to a new illness, a new virus, as when the pandemic started, they feel appropriate because we're used to seeing them applied to lots of different kinds of problems and difficulties or different types of hardship. And so then it makes sense when they get extended to a new problem or type of hardship. So their conventionality helps when they are used to a new in relation to a new situation. But then there are further implications. So first of all, when people like Boris Johnson or President Trump used the metaphors, they used them in relation to two different aspects of the COVID pandemic. One was the individual one. So when an individual is sick, and both Boris Johnson early on and then later Donald Trump had COVID, the metaphor was applied not just by them, but by other people to them as individuals being sick with COVID and trying to get better. And at the individual level, it's the patient, the person who is sick, fighting the illness. And within the metaphor, if the person is strong and tough, they're more likely to get better. And in both cases, that was said about both of them. And then when they recovered, there was this idea that they recovered because they were tough and they were strong. This is a very problematic framing of illness at the individual level, because it suggests that getting better or otherwise depends on you and depends, if you like, on your character. Of course, it works for people like Johnson or Trump because then they become heroes in their own narrative. But then it suggests that the people who don't get better or who struggle to get better are somehow less determined or less have a less strong character than they do. So this is problematic, and it applies equally to being ill with cancer, which is something that I'm sure we'll go on to. Then there is a collective societal level where the metaphor was applied, that we are all together as a society at war with the pandemic. And that was a metaphor that was used not just by Trump and Johnson, but by most political leaders I'm aware of in the world. Partly it's because of what we've just said. The metaphor is there. We use it conventionally to talk about all sorts of problems, and we can just apply to this new problem. But in addition, it was because the pandemic, at least in the way it was experienced by many governments and populations, was a sudden, new, enormous problem. And so describing as a war was a way to suggest how seriously we had to take it and what deep the consequences might be, both in terms of what it might do and in terms of what we had to sacrifice to deal with it. Now, in that context, the research that was conducted even before COVID suggested that, on the one hand, metaphors of war can be effective in making people feel that the problem is serious and urgent, and that people have to modify their lifestyles to deal with it. But on the other hand, apart from the ethical concerns with framing anything as a war, the metaphor also has some potential problems, the virus did not want to harm us. The virus doesn't have any intentions like an enemy does of harming you. So in that sense, it was partly misrepresentation. There was the danger that within a war framing, it is to be expected that people die. And so it might make it easier to accept large numbers of casualties. Within a war, there are extreme measures being taken. Governments have a bigger role in people's lives than in peacetime. And again, then within a war framing, it might make it easier for people to accept governmental measures that might otherwise be regarded as authoritarian. And then in wars, there are heroes. So healthcare professionals could be framed as heroes who were seen to be sort of heroic because of sacrificing their lives by getting sick themselves and dying, which again is questionable. So a war framing has some potential advantages at the beginning of a new crisis. But beyond that, it has many potential disadvantages. And these were amply discussed at the time, not just by researchers, but by journalists, politicians, commentators, and ordinary people.
So that makes sense that as a situation evolves, and when it's novel, using a familiar and at least seemingly appropriate metaphor like a battle or a war, or we're fighting something unknown, is appropriate. But by not sort of shifting the narrative or not adding nuance or changing that as casualties mounted, reinforced this idea that we are at battle, that, and perhaps it could have, you know, influenced even people's perceptions of masking as something that maybe the government was overreaching on rather than something that you were doing to protect both yourselves and those around you. So I could see how, I could see the utility of it, and I could also see how it outlived its expiration date with the pandemic pretty early on.
Yes, and in fact, there are studies that show that war metaphors were used frequently at the beginning of the pandemic, and then their frequency decreased. They never disappear because of their conventionality, which we've talked about. But I think there were reasons why they were used more at the beginning, partly for this idea of suddenly conveying to people how serious this is, but also because there was belief that victory could be achieved relatively quickly. And I think even for the politicians and the leaders of various countries, as time went on, it became clear that there wasn't going to be anytime soon a moment of victory. And indeed, it also became clear that there would never be that, you know, obviously things got much better and life started to be progressively normal again. But, you know, COVID is still around. And, you know, people who knew about these things told us right from the start that it would be around pretty much forever. And so then the war metaphor became less appropriate, or if you like, even less convenient for the political leaders who had used it so much at the beginning. In terms of the dominance of particular metaphors, it's not just a matter of metaphors becoming potentially less useful over time. It is also the fact that any metaphor you use for any phenomenon or aspect of experience is going to give you a partial perspective. The framing is always going to cover some aspects better than others. And therefore, when a problem is complex and serious, it is useful to have multiple metaphors because different metaphors will do better justice to some aspects of it and not others. And also having multiple metaphors means they were not stuck inside one single way of thinking about a thing. And that is why I think it was important even at the beginning to use different metaphors. It would have been better if a range of different metaphors were used rather than relying primarily and initially on the war metaphor.
Hi, folks. This is Joe breaking in for just a second. We've been talking to Dr. Elena Cimino about harnessing the power of metaphors to make sense of and communicate our experience of illness. For your convenience, we've placed links to recently published articles in health communication on our Facebook page. Okay, back to the conversation. Battle metaphors are also ubiquitous in cancer, and not just in public discourse. You see it among cancer patients, their families, their friends. The idea of battling cancer is almost impossible to erase from our memories or our vocabularies when we talk about it, even to the point where I've seen obituaries of people who have passed away from cancer written by their relatives, and the first line will be that so-and-so lost his battle to cancer. So this is now not at a sort of public figure or public level of discourse. It's at an individual level. And so I'm curious about the effects there. And is there subjective benefits from a person who, let's say a person with cancer feels embattled, and this is a metaphor they choose to use. Is that choice in and of itself something that will override maybe the more problematic aspects of using a battle metaphor?
Yes. So there are several different questions in there. So first of all, yes, battle metaphors are particularly prevalent in relation to cancer, both at the societal level when people talk about the war against cancer. President Nixon had that slogan, but particularly, as you say, at the individual level where people describe themselves as or people describe their relatives or friends as fighting cancer, battling cancer, being a fighter. So the reason why we do this is what I've already explained, is because of the pervasiveness of the sort of basic metaphor of difficulties as opponents. With regard to cancer in particular, this framing has been generally, when it is discussed, it is criticized. Precisely because in that framing, if people don't get better, they lose the battle. And if somebody loses a battle, they could feel responsible. So in the work that my colleagues and I did on metaphors and cancer, we found people writing about their own experience in these terms and saying things like, one particular person writing on an online forum said, "I feel such a failure that I'm not winning this battle," after saying that the cancer had spread. So why should the person feel a failure? You know, the treatment has failed, but why should the person feel a failure? It's that framing, not winning. So again, you know, going back also to the heroic framing of Boris Johnson being ill with COVID, in that framing, if you're strong enough, you get better, and if not, you lose. So that is a particularly problematic framing. And indeed, my colleagues and I, a few years ago, did an experiment where we gave participants two different versions of a story about somebody with cancer. In one story, the person's cancer was framed as a battle, and in the other as a journey. And one of the questions we asked the two groups after they read that story was, how guilty do you think this person will feel if they don't get better? And the person who read the battle version of the story attributed greater feelings of guilt to this imaginary cancer patient than the people who read the journey metaphor. So there really are consequences potentially here. On the other hand, we are all different people. Cancer is not a single illness, but many, and there are different stages of cancer. Even a single person doesn't feel the same every day or every moment of their lives about something like an illness, a serious illness. And therefore, it is absolutely fine and acceptable for people to choose to frame their relationship with the illness as a battle, or to describe themselves as fighters. And in our work on metaphors and cancer, we found that for some people, some of the time, that metaphor was empowering. And it's the word fighter in particular is very interesting, because when people are described metaphorically as fighters, sometimes it's used for premature babies who survive against the odds. They're described as fighters. And partly it's an optimistic framing. But partly, when somebody is described metaphorically as a fighter, the focus is on being determined. It's much less on the enemy. And in fact, the enemy is not really very much part of the framing, but it's actually something, a praise for the person. And in that context, it is absolutely important that people can use those words if they think they're appropriate. And I'm saying this, I mean, why no metaphor should be censored at the individual level, especially when it comes to illness. Everybody should be free to use the metaphors that work for them. And sometimes there are slight attempts to censor these particular metaphors. However, what is problematic is when this kind of metaphorical framing is so dominant that people end up using it because it's the one that's most readily available, or it's the one that seems more natural because everybody uses it. And so then in that context, people don't necessarily freely choose a particular framing, but are pushed into it by the fact that it's so pervasive. And that is why this is such a complex area. What I usually say is that at the individual level, people should be enabled and encouraged to use the metaphors that work best for them. But we do need to be conscious of the metaphors that are inadvertently imposed on people because they're so dominant in newspapers, in charity slogans, etc. So that is why this is such a complex and sensitive area.
And it sounds like it would be wise to remind people that you don't have to stick with the initial metaphor, because I think maybe we don't always have a vocabulary for coming up with new metaphors, and maybe a cancer patient might feel like they're embattled in the beginning and during the course of treatment never think to revise it or to come up with something new. And so it carries forward almost passively in a sense.
Yes, that is absolutely right. And one of the outcomes of a project that my colleagues and I did at Lancaster University a few years ago was to produce what we call a metaphor menu for people with cancer. Is it all right if I talk about that?
Oh, please do. That's exactly where okay. We were heading.
All right. Okay. When my colleagues and I were working on a project on metaphors and cancer a few years ago in England, we involved in our research a group of local people who had personal experience with cancer. And their input was extremely useful because they challenged us, they enlightened us, etc., and they gave us perspectives that were from their own lived experience rather than, from research experience. And one of the ways in which we were once challenged was that one member of this group asked us, said, well, what are you going to do based on this project that is going to be useful? Are you going to produce a list of guidelines of good metaphors and bad metaphors so people know what to do? And I remember when this question was asked, basically responding that one of our findings was that different metaphors work differently for different people. And for some people, even the battle metaphor that is so criticized by many, for some people, it works really well, at least some of the time. So we couldn't provide a list of good metaphors or bad metaphors that worked for everyone. And I remember then going home that evening thinking about this conversation and thinking, I just gave this person the classic academic answer. I've basically said that things are more complicated than this person thought. And so I thought, how do I meet the spirit of that question if I can't meet the letter of that question? And so that's where I had the idea of producing not a set of guidelines of do's and don'ts for the reasons that I said, but giving a way of giving people choice. And so then I came up with the idea of a metaphor menu for people with cancer. Of course, the menu is a metaphor, but the idea is precisely that, like in a restaurant, if we go out to eat, we will like different things on the menu. And that's okay. Different people like different things, or you might have different things from the same restaurant on different days. But the whole idea is there is choice, that different choices are most appropriate for different people or at different moments. And if you go to a restaurant to eat nice food, you might be inspired to come up with a variant of the one of the dishes yourself or to make up a new dish. So the metaphor menu for people with cancer, which is online, available online, you just need to Google it, is a selection of, we ended up with 17 metaphors used by real people and providing a range of different perspectives on cancer. So the idea is that we need multiple metaphors for something as complex and difficult and such a often a long experience like cancer, but also that we might at different points or different people might benefit from different metaphors. That to me is the important thing with metaphor, whether it's used in healthcare or in education or in politics, that we need a variety of metaphors because each metaphor gives us a different perspective.
I love the menu. I think that that's not only just practical, but it's ingenious. And it really then brings, as you said, the academic to the people, right? So it's not just an academic pursuit. Metaphors can be useful in our everyday lives. And if you're having trouble coming up with one for your situation, if you have cancer, you can sort of see how other cancer patients have framed this. And like you said, you may not necessarily choose one of those exactly, but maybe it'll inspire you to find one that really you create for your own unique situation. It's very empowering to think that that lives there. And so I hope our readers will go and visit that. And we'll put a link to the menu on in our show notes so that they can see that.
That would be great. That would be absolutely great.
Are there any metaphors in particular from that or even from the metaphor work you did with COVID that stood out to you?
In the metaphor menu, there is a musical metaphor. Healing is to get the cancer cells to sing in tune with the rest of the body. And I always liked that metaphor because in that metaphor, the cancer is not an opponent. There's no opponent. It's also not a journey metaphor that is, you know, people talk about the cancer journey, a hard road, which is also useful, but also rather conventional. But the illness is lack of harmony in the body, and getting better is to reestablish that, in this case, musical harmony. And so I find that a metaphor that is lighthearted, but not inappropriately so. And it actually reminds me of metaphors for illness from different cultural traditions. There are, you know, here I don't want to oversimplify, but in Western thought, very broadly speaking, an illness is an invasion into your body from outside. But previously, during the time when people thought of different humors in the body, and then if you go to some Asian cultures, illness can be seen as lack of balance, imbalance in the body. And that is a different framing than illness being somebody who attacks you or invades you. And that musical metaphor in the menu, I like for that reason, that is to do with harmony. In terms of COVID, so you've alluded to the paper I wrote, this was at the end of 2020, on metaphors for COVID. At the time, it was still fairly early on in the pandemic, although at the time we hoped it wasn't early on, but it was. I noticed that fire metaphors of COVID as fire, were potentially quite useful. And I wrote that in that paper. Since then, I have sometimes been slightly misrepresented by saying that everybody should use them, or they were superior to other metaphors, whereas at the time it was an observation based on data that metaphor could do quite a range of things compared with other metaphors. And so I still stand by that in those early months, fire metaphors were particularly useful and versatile based on the linguistic data I had. But then again, as time went on, even that metaphor became less useful, and other metaphors potentially became more useful. One of my favorites, which I think I also mentioned in that health communication paper, is the metaphor of heroism as being like a hedgehog and rolling up into a ball and hoping for better times. And this was a metaphor for the initial lockdowns. It comes from Norwegian. It was actually provided by a Norwegian colleague. She heard it on in the Norwegian media. And to me, it was a very good way of capturing what it was like to be in those first lockdowns and how that lack of activity was in itself a heroic act. Of course, you know, the people who went out, not just to deliver food and but even more to treat people in hospitals and keep schools going where they were kept going, etc., were doing a much harder job. But being stuck at home was also very difficult. And that metaphor started with don't roar like a lion or fight like a giant. So it negated an active, aggressive approach to what a hero is and turned the idea on its head and said, at this point, being heroic is being like a hedgehog that kind of goes dormant and does nothing for months. That to me was the power of metaphor to reconceptualize the notion of heroism for a very specific moment when everything changed for us. And that is also one of my favorites.
Well, those are really rich metaphors. I'd like to segue a little into humor because your work has also touched on humor in medical settings. And I would imagine that that's equally complex and nuanced. There are people that would say there's no room for that. In my personal experience, I don't know how anyone would cope with serious illness and medical problems without finding some way to tap into humor, whether irreverent or self-deprecating, like you talk about. Can you talk a little bit about what your research has uncovered about the use of humor in medical settings?
Yes, sure. So when we were working on metaphors in cancer, we were looking at people's narratives on online forums. And we set out with a bunch of research questions about which metaphors were used, what the implications might be, etc. But we did not have any research questions or research goals relating to humor, even though humor is a big topic in linguistics and the study of communication. But the thing is, then we came across humor over and over and over again on these cancer forums. And so then we decided, well, we need to look at this. Now, in some ways, for the reason you just said, we shouldn't be surprised. Making fun of things, being lighthearted about things, using humor is a central part of communication and how we approach things. We laugh together, we entertain each other with humor, but humor has some very specific functions that are relevant to illness. One is distancing yourself from the illness by laughing at it. And one of the functions of humor is disparaging others. Sometimes that can be quite mean, but if you're distancing yourself from your illness and seeing it as an object of ridicule, it's one way to cope with it. And another function of humor is emotional release, so that you can diffuse a difficult situation by using humor. Now, humor is also potentially a dangerous communicative strategy. So not everybody can joke about cancer. It depends on who is using humor and when, so it can go very wrong. But on these particular forums, it was people who shared at that point the experience of being ill with cancer, joking with each other and making light of it with each other. And then we noticed that that seemed to have a really important function for people because it was partly this function of releasing emotional tension, seeing things in a way that was less serious and less tragic, but also bonding with each other. Because what we then found was that at least on one particular forum, which was completely dedicated to humor, it was huge, a huge thread. People developed over months sometimes, and sharing the in-joke was basically evidence that you were part of the community, as in any other context with families and friends that there are in-jokes that only the people who are in the in-group understand. And that sense of being part of an in-group who share a joke or multiple jokes about something as serious as cancer clearly had a very important function for people. And we actually had to partly change our methods in order to deal with it, because I won't go into the details because it's kind of boring, but we use computer-aided methods to analyze large data sets. And that often involves looking at each instance, let's say, of a particular metaphor in its very immediate context, but without, for example, reading a whole forum or whole posts. But when we found these in-jokes, we couldn't understand them. So we found examples of, you know, people joking about playing the cancer card, or missions to liberate people from hospital with weird references to things we couldn't understand. And then we said, oh, here we can't understand the data. We actually need to read the whole thing. And it involved a lot of work to do justice to what these communities, these groups of people were doing online. And it was both very revealing and very humbling as well.
Yeah, it sounds like a wonderful source of support and adaptive coping for people with cancer, to be able to have those in language to bond over the humor in their experiences or as they see it, and to distance themselves, as you mentioned.
Yes, absolutely. Yeah.
If I remember correctly, you had also had findings on physicians' use of humor in medical settings, and not necessarily guidelines, but sort of findings about when and what circumstances would actually humor be helpful if it were initiated by the physician. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Yes, here we have, I have much less data. I've worked with colleagues on the use of humor in emergency department interactions in an Australian hospital. I think here we found that it's a preliminary study, so we don't have as much data as, for example, for the cancer project. But we found that there are differences in who uses humor and how much in that context. And I think the patients came out as using more humor. However, humor can reduce social distance, right? If you can share a joke with people, any distance in terms of hierarchy or in terms of level of intimacy gets reduced. And so where it's appropriate, because of course humor can also be perceived as inappropriate, but where it's appropriate, it reduces that sense of, for example, hierarchical distance. It can also, of course, diffuse situations that may be problematic, for example, embarrassing situations in the context of physical examinations. It can, you know, appeal to a kind of common humanity beyond the context of patient versus physician. So there are multiple functions that humor can perform. It can be self-deprecating, and in our data from emergency departments, patients sometimes use self-deprecating humor. So it can have an important function, but as I said before, it can also be a risky strategy. So it always needs to be appropriate, because humor can also backfire. And then if it backfires, it's unhelpful.
Oh, that makes a lot of sense. And it sounds like it involves whether how well the patient and the physician trust and know each other, and the individual circumstances. But in some cases, there was some preliminary indication that patients had higher satisfaction ratings with their physicians when the physicians used appropriate humor or initiated appropriate humor.
Yes, and that makes sense, that that humor tends to reduce social distance, as I said, and is something that can have a bonding function, as it did on the online forum, especially if people co-construct the humor. And that is something that happens in interaction, whether it's synchronous, like in a context of a medical examination, or non-synchronous, as in an online forum. Co-constructing humor is a very strong bonding exercise.
Well, we're going to wrap up a little bit now, but I have two final things. The first is, do you have a favorite metaphor or way of describing your work as a linguistic scholar?
I never thought about this. I think I don't remember using metaphors to describe my work, but one metaphor that I could use, I also grow vegetables, which is quite a foolhardy enterprise in the northwest of England. Sometimes it works, sometimes it doesn't, because it rains so much. But I think doing research is not unlike trying to grow vegetables or fruit. You need to do a lot of work because before you can harvest, and then you don't know which plants or which bits of your orchard, the vegetable patches, are going to finally produce things or not. And sometimes even doing the same thing again isn't going to work out in the same way. So that is one metaphor for my research, a kind of, farming or vegetable growing metaphor. The other metaphor that I think sometimes I have at least used for myself is that I often work with groups of people, and I like working with teams, and sometimes I'm in charge of a team. And there I think of it as sometimes as being the conductor of an orchestra, that you're trying to get each person to do the best that they can with their bit of it, so that the overall effect is, effective and potentially stunning. And sometimes, there are bits that are out of tune. Sometimes it works, sometimes it doesn't. But yeah, sort of vegetable growing and orchestras probably are my metaphors for my work.
Well, I think both of those are apt, because in preparing for the podcast and reading your scholarship and the depth of scholarship that you've created, it seems like a very bountiful harvest, and really the words sang off the page to me as someone who loves language and literature.
Oh, this is very good.
I'm glad to know that you can apply your talents and your expertise towards yourself and find those metaphors too. Well, let's end with where we began, which was with your health communication article about COVID-19 and metaphors. And there was a particular passage that I thought was really beautiful and eloquent about the power of metaphors. I was wondering if you could read that for us.
Metaphors are too precious a resource to do without. They greatly expand our conceptual and communicative abilities, as we can draw from the knowledge and language that we have for concrete experiences to reason and communicate about other experiences for which we may otherwise have little vocabulary and conceptual structure. In the same way as they can be used to deceive and prevaricate, metaphors can also be used to enlighten and comfort. The issue is not whether or not they should be used, but how they should be used.
Dr. Elena Cimino, thank you for joining Defining Moments today.
It was a pleasure. Thank you for having me.
Thanks for joining Dr. Elena Cimino and I for this episode of the Defining Moments podcast. Defining Moments is produced by WOUB Public Media and the Barbara Gerrards Institute for Storytelling and Social Impact. The Institute imagines a world where storytelling creates just and joyful communities. Lynn Harder and I are co-producers, and Colin Cameron is our audio engineer. You can subscribe to Defining Moments at Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or the NPR Podcast Directory. Please follow us on Facebook and Instagram at DMPodcastWOUB. On our Facebook page, we provide links to Dr. Cimino's articles published in Health Communication, as well as the metaphor menu she mentioned in this episode. We hope you'll take the time to rate and review this podcast. Thanks and be well.